Good afternoon, everyone. We have spent a month working on the Midah of Chesed. It's a Midah that Rebbeim spoke about, giving, taking care of others. It's a Midah that's, I'll tell you, very, very dear and near to my heart, in that I certainly want to achieve some level of dedication to Chesed. But we know that my father's a Zichrono Livracha, certainly. If there are three pillars of the world, Torah, Avodah, and Gemilas Chasadim, Gemilas Chesed, the ability to devote yourselves to the betterment of the rest of the Jewish people, was the one that he really focused on greatly. My father, Zichrono Livracha, was very fortunate to have very, very few people that he felt very, very close to. People that he felt were similarly dedicated to causes like himself, and he knew that such people would be able to take it to the next level. Our speaker that we have today, I doubt when he was your age, he thought that he would be a speaker coming to a yeshiva to speak, but he is a speaker that we are all going to get a tremendous amount from. Simcha Shein, aside from being a very, very wonderful and dear friend of the family and of myself, and certainly who's very, very close with my father, he is a person who is dedicated to Klal Yisrael, is a person who does everything that you can imagine. From morning to night, I don't like to look at statuses, but his status I have to look at because I never heard of any hospital that he goes to. It's just tons of hospitals with his car everywhere, and it's a schus for the yeshiva to get to hear from him. I just want to prep it just for a moment. Simcha Shein is going to speak first. At the end, he has made himself available to answer questions. If people have questions, when people have questions, you can he'll answer any question on any topic, and you can really, really get a tremendous boon out of what you can learn from Simcha today. It's our schos, our privilege to hear from Simcha Shein. Please.
I'm very privileged to be here. I always love to talk about what I do. I love to talk about Chesed. But the person who introduced me to Chesed is the namesake that is sitting on all your sweatshirts, and that was Reb Shlomo Zakkai. Chesed, as we know, is universal. You know, when I grew up, right across the street from me, we had an Italian guy. They said he was actually part of the mafia. And he had a Chesed too. He used to pay me $10 every morning just to start his car. Now, anybody here ever hear of the red car theory? Anybody know what the red car theory is? What's the red car theory?
Start noticing a red car all the time you think about it.
Correct. That is actually what the red car theory is. So anybody drive here today, walk here today? Where do you guys come from? I saw some guys walking in the street before, coming back from the pizza shop or somewhere. Who is that, you? How many red cars did you see today? You did?
Yeah,
what kind of cars were they?
It was
an Nissan Altima. Yeah, you're very good. Most people would not notice how many red cars they passed. However, if we would offer them $100 for every red car that they saw, they'd probably recognize a lot of red cars. And maybe even some, you know, maroon cars, they would say, is also that. But that red car theory is something that Shlomo Zakkai, Zichrono Livracha, taught me. That if you look for chesed, if you look for opportunity, you're going to find it. If your eyes are focused on the ground and you're not looking around, you're not going to find it. In Pirkei Avos, it always says, "Aselecha Rav, uknelecha Chaver," and that was who Reb Shlomo Zakkai was. He was a life full of chesed. And they always say, if you want to find somebody to do something, of course, give it to a busy person. Not because the busy person gets to do it, but the busy person knows how to create time in their day in order to be able to get it done. And one of the things that people learn in business and investments, I'll tell you a little bit about my background, about what I do. So when people ask me what I do, I tell them I'm a Hatzalah paramedic. That's really what I do. That's my life. That's my chesed. But what I do is I run a private jet charter company. But our company, we provide aircraft for corporate executives who have to go on trips. But more importantly, We fly patients and we fly organ transplant teams around the country to pick up hearts and lungs and livers and kidneys and whatever else they might do. My phone might buzz in the middle because you actually have a transplant that's going on right now in Dayton, Ohio. We're going to go pick up a heart that's going to come back to New Jersey. And Be'ez Hashem, somebody's going to get a new heart today. But Warren Buffett is one of the people that I follow. Anybody know who Warren Buffett is? One of the wealthiest people, one of the biggest investors. And he said the one thing, the benefit that he has is that he gets to analyze deals before he goes into them. Unless he's very, very confident, 100%, he says no to most deals. And that works in business. Really important. In business, people throw deals at you, just say no to everything until you find that perfect deal. But in Chesed, Shlomo would say, you need to find a way to say yes. It's very simple for somebody to come up and say, hey, can you do me a favor? And it's like, oh, I'll go down the block and bring it back. Like, I can't do it, right? I don't have the time. But if you want to focus on saying yes, you'll be able to do some great things. I remember after Rabbi Shlomo, who was so near and dear to me, passed away, I remember that Rabbi Eli Mansour actually spoke at his Shleishim, and he spoke at Rabbi Yanki Meyer's Levaya. And he said the same exact thing. He said, the further we get away, and I'm sure Rabbi Moshe has mentioned in the past, the further we get away from Har Sinai, the weaker our Torah is. There will never be another Chafetz Chaim, there will never be another Vilna Goy. It just can't be, because we just get weaker the further we get. There will never be another Rav Chaim Kanievsky. But the one thing that gets stronger as we get closer to Mashiach is Chesed. Why and how? I'll tell you how. Because back, if you go in the early 1900s, right, they would do chesed. They live in a small town in Poland or in Hungary. So chesed was, you had a soup kitchen. They gave, maybe helped some people make weddings, but that's as far as it went. Now chesed goes across the world. The opportunity for chesed, it goes out over a WhatsApp group. They have razor campaigns. Everything can happen. But Moshe is able to run such a beautiful yeshiva because of the chesed of others. And I remember, and I just want to talk a little bit about Rav Shlomo, about what I did, the opportunities that I had with Rav Shlomo. So I met him actually on 9/11. I don't believe any of you were born then, but 9/11 was a day that really changed the world. Who would have thought that we can be attacked, that planes would come into the World Trade Center? And Rav Shlomo owned a very large ambulance company at that point, and he brought in many. He just kept ambulance after ambulance was coming in, and unfortunately, some of his personnel passed away when the towers collapsed. But I got to meet him that day. And then about a month after that, Shlomo created something called the Heart Team. They were concerned that there was going to be intifadas in Eretz Yisrael. And all the paramedics and doctors all have to go up to the front lines. So who's going to cover the cities? Who's going to cover Yerushalayim and Tel Aviv and Bnei Brak and Cholon? So Shlomo actually paid for it. And he brought down, I was part of the first group of 20, Heart Team 1. That we went down to Eretz Yisrael and we trained with Magen David Adom, and we went on numerous missions afterwards. We were in Ashkelon and Sderot and bomb shelters and everything else was what we did. But I never understood what his blueprint was, because he was about chesed and he was always in shul on time and he was always learning Daf Yomi. And I remember at the Shleishim, I went over to Rav Moshe's mother, to Dr. Fay, and I said, I got it. I know exactly Shlomo's blueprint. And we say it every day. And I'm going to show it to you. And for those, I'm sure Moshe can attest, and I'm sure Yehuda Leib can attest as well. And I'm going to go through the list, and you'll let me know if that's accurate of Shlomo Zakim. Yehuda Leib, is that fair? This is what we say every day. Eilu devarim she'en la sha'adam oichel perisem bo'ilam hazeh v'akeren kayemes lo'ilam abav. Eilu heim. Kiba dava'im. Shlomo is a legend, right? How he took care of his father, and he took care of his mother. Right, Moshe, is that correct so far? So that's check one? No problem. Gemilas Chasadim, 2. Hashkamas Beis Hamidrash Shachris VeArvis. Hachnasas Archim. So many homes. Still continues with Dr. Fay with Hachnasas Archim. Birka Chaylim. Hachnasas Kala. Levayis Hames. I'll tell you what they said actually by the Levayer, by the Shleishim, that Reb Shlomi used to go to Shomer Hadas, which is the funeral chapel on 14th Avenue. He would drive by in the morning. And he would walk in and he would say, are there any Levias that weren't paid for yet? And it didn't matter if they had money or they didn't have money. And if they said no, he would write a check to pay for that Levaya. Okay? So that's what we got. So we're up to V'ayisames. Iyun tefila. Havar shalom en adam lechavera v'sama taira. He sat and he learned every single day. So that was his blueprint. Now, I don't know. I can for sure. I don't. Usually people pick one or two or three. Nobody picks all of them, but that's what he did. That was his blueprint. He was a true Eved Hashem who tried to do so much, and most of what he did was the chesed that he did. No problem. So I grew up as a Lakewood kid, just no different than any one of you. We didn't have the resources and the amazing yeshivas and schools that we had. So I went to 4 elementary schools. I went to 7 camps. Now, I didn't go to camp because I was different camps because I was thrown out of camps. But I went to camps wherever my father got the best deal is actually where I went to camp. And I'll tell you, my first business deal happened when I was going to camp. I was 11 years old. It was summer 1984. And I was going to a camp called Camp Kalrina. Camp Kalrina was a camp really for wealthy people. My parents didn't have the money to send me to an expensive camp. My father knew Mr. Greenwald. And my father reached out to him before camp, and he gave him an offer of $300 for me to come to camp. Mr. Greenwald says, $300? I can't take you to camp for $300. Camp costs like $1,100 then. So my father said, I'll call you back. 3 days after camp, 3 days after camp starts, my father calls and says, any empty beds available? He goes, yeah, we actually have one empty bed in Bunk Anche Knesset Hagadola. And if you want to send your son, you can. So my father sends me the next day. My father had work to do. So he sent me up to camp with a plastic salesman. His name was Alan Dershowitz. Not to be confused with the lawyer Alan Dershowitz, who was his cousin. But he was a plastic salesman who would travel around the mountains and all over the place. He would sell them tablecloths and garbage bags. And my father said, you're going to go in the car with him, and eventually at some point today, you're going to end up in Camp Kalrina. So we get into the car, we drive, he'd go to every little stop. He would put the window down because he wouldn't leave the car on because it cost money for fuel. And it wasn't illegal then. You wouldn't get arrested. And I would sit there and I would wait while he went out. Before I left the camp, my father gave me a couple dollars. When I say a couple, literally a couple dollars. He gave me $4 so that I can call home every Friday. Now, I knew I wasn't calling home every Friday, so I had $4. And he gave me another $3. And my mother felt bad. And my mother actually gave me 2 pans of frozen cake to take with me. That was it. I didn't know if I was going to take it to camp or throw it in the garbage, but I took the cakes with me. And the last stop that we made before we got to Camp Kalrina was in a camp called Camp Shane. Sounds the same as mine, spelled a little different, spelled S-H-A-N-E. Rabbi Moshe, did you ever hear of Camp Shane? Never. Did you? What was Camp Shane?
I know it was in the cats.
Do you know what it was? It was a Weight Watchers camp.
Oh, really?
It was a Weight Watchers camp for large, rich children. Yeah. It was based in Ferndale, right near Camp Aguda, right? And that was the last place we went to. So we come in, and he goes into the office there, and I'm sitting in the car. There's a little yeshiva kid from Lakewood, and these kids come over to my car, and I said, how you doing? I'm like, Baruch Hashem. And they said, you have any food? I'm like, no, I don't have food. I wasn't even thinking about food. They're like, we'll buy it. I said, well, I have 2 cakes. It's for my mother, and it's not for sale. Everything's for sale, right? So anybody want to take a guess on how much I sold 2 cakes the summer? I mean, I don't know if you can think about how old this was. The summer of 1984. So 40 years ago, right? 40 years ago. What do you think we got for 2 cakes? $20, $50? $1. Who said $1? Seriously? You think I would sell 2 cakes for $1? $90. Okay? $90 in 1984. We believe it was probably about $400 or $500 that I sold 2 cakes. Now, I never had money in my life. I had $7 before. I walk into camp with $97. I was so scared I was going to be mugged or robbed. I actually used to keep it in my sock. And then for Shabbos, I would hide it in my mattress under the thing. But that's really what it was. So that was my first business deal that I did. After that, I went to yeshiva. As I said, I went to 4 elementary schools, 7 camps, 2 high schools, 2 base medrashes, and then I had to go make money because I wanted to be able to raise a family, and I opened a taxi company, and then I opened up a clothing store that's still open in Lakewood, and then I ran a limo company, and I worked for a caterer, and at some point, I bought into a bail bonds company. Anybody know what bail bonds are? Right? Right, so we would bail people out of jail. At some point, it was probably the largest bail company in the state of New Jersey, and I used to do what was called Future of Recovery, so we'd pick up skips, bounty hunting. We did that as well, and that went from probably 1998 till about just after 9/11 is when I ran this company. And I went into that, and then afterwards, as I mentioned before, after that I met Rav Shlomo, And he became my Rebbe. He became my mentor. He became my friend. And he even became my business partner, too. Not that he needed me as a business partner, but he knew that I was looking for something to do. And we ended up opening up 3 long-term pharmacies together. And the amazing thing about Shlomo was when he would give me an opportunity for chesed, I realized that if Shlomo would ask me what I was doing, the answer was always the same thing. What was it? What are you doing? Nothing. You're absolutely right, Yehuda Leib. The answer always had to be nothing because he never wanted to bother anybody. But if you said the word nothing, you got such tremendous opportunities with him. And because we had these tremendous opportunities, one day he asked me, I was sitting in the office, he goes, what are you doing? And I said, nothing. He goes, you want to go to Camp Simcha? I said, what's Camp Simcha? Now, I heard about it, but I was never there before. So we get into his car, and we go down to the FDR Drive, and next thing we know, there's a helicopter sitting there, and 43 minutes later, we're in Camp Simcha. And that's where he brought me in. He said, what are you doing this summer? What did I say?
Nothing.
Nothing, correct. And I became a paramedic in Camp Simcha. And then one day, I was sitting in his office, and he says, I was sitting at home, and he says, what are you doing today? And I said, nothing. And he said, bring your passport and come to New York. So I got my passport. I didn't ask any more questions. I got my passport. I got into the car. And next thing you know, we ended up in Havana, Cuba. You couldn't guess Cuba? Seriously? We went to Havana, Cuba. Actually, I shouldn't say that day, because that day we were actually on our way to Havana, Cuba. We're in the airport. On the way to the airport, on the Bell Parkway. And Reb Shlomo got a message to pull over to the side. It was an email he was getting in Spanish. It wasn't as easy to get emails then as it is to get right now on our phone. He pulls over and he says, do you know Spanish? And I said, no, I don't know any Spanish. He says, what does arrestido mean? I said, arrestido? I don't know. Arresto? I don't know. Arrested? Yeah, that's what you think of, man. We had no way to Google it, but we got told that if we show up today, they're going to arrest us because we were going with them well to go do a mila in Cuba. So we came back home. Your mother was very surprised because we had left. And then 30 minutes later, we're back home, and she's like, what do you mean? I'm going out to dinner now with my friends. But anyway, exactly. She called it in. Anyway, so we came back, and we went then, I think 2 days later, we went again. We went to Rabbi Fisher, and we went to Cuba. Now, we couldn't go directly to Cuba because it was illegal to go. And it's past the statute of limitations, so I can talk about it right now openly. I think it's over 10 years, and this is like in 2011, I think. I have the video. I'll show it to you guys afterwards if you want to see it. But we went to Havana, Cuba. We couldn't go direct, so we flew from here, from Farmingdale Airport, we flew to the Bahamas. The Bahamas, there was another plane that took us to Cuba. But these are the things that we would do. Shlomo also introduced me to something called helicopters. Okay, I knew nothing about aviation until I met Shlomo. And as I mentioned, the first time everyone in a helicopter was that day that I went to Camp Simcha. And then every summer, Shlomo would arrange for helicopters to fly children who aren't well, children who are sick, children who have cancer, medical disabilities, ventilators. We'd fly them on helicopters. And to this day, we actually fly about 500 or 600 kids and young adults on helicopters every summer. Now, one of the people that Shlomo introduced me was somebody named Beinish Mendel, Beinish Zichrono Livracha, a very, very near and dear friend. Beinish, unfortunately, was sick as well. Beinish had cancer, and Beinish was being treated in Los Angeles in a hospital called City of Hope, in City of Hope, California. And Beinish had what's called a bone marrow transplant, and after the bone marrow transplant, for 100 days, you can't go back home. You have to stay because you have to go back and forth at a hospital every day for tests. They were immunocompromised. You had to be very, very careful. All his food had to be burnt. We used to actually take his food and put it into a toaster oven so it would burn it off so there would be no bacteria or anything else like that on it. One morning, I was sitting out there, and actually that weekend that we were there, Shlomo came with a bunch of people that he flew in to surprise Beinish for Shabbos. Anyway, I was sitting there one night, and Beinish says, you know, tomorrow morning, I want to go to City of Hope. We usually have to get there around 11 o'clock, but I want to go a little earlier in the day because there's a Hasidic Shayid from Mea Sharim who's getting a bone marrow transplant. And because I know what a bone marrow transplant was, and because I am a Kayin, I want to go before his procedure, and I want to give him a Birchas Kayin. He took his Kayin job very, very seriously. And we said, okay, and we get into the car, we leave early in the morning, and we're driving, we get stuck in horrible, horrible Los Angeles traffic, and we finally show up to City of Hope. We come walking up to the place, and there's an alcove, so all the rooms where the patients would lay, especially cancer patients, They'd be sitting, there'd be an alcove at a big window, and we'd come running in, and Beinish actually knew the nurse who was sitting there, and he says, "Oh, how you doing? I just came to give the rabbi the blessing before he gets his transplant." And the nurse says, "You're too late. You missed it. You gave it to him 20 minutes ago." He goes, "What am I going to do?" He says, "But I'm so happy you're here, because this rabbi's wife only speaks Hebrew or Yiddish, and I was trying to let her know what's going to happen over the next couple of days. Perhaps you can relate to her what's going to happen." She said, "Okay, absolutely." So we're set up at this alcove, so we're sitting here. There's a big window behind us, and the guy says, "I'm going to tell you, Beinish," or Alan as they called him, "what you should tell to this woman, this Yerushalmi lady." And he says, "I'm just letting you know that over the next 48 hours or so, your husband is not going to move from that bed. He's not going to move. He is so weak after this transplant." And we're like, "Okay." And let her know she shouldn't be worried, because we're going to watch him and he's going to be okay, but he's not going to move. And as he's talking with his back towards us, he watches as we all are looking like this. And as he talks, he turns around, and this Hasidish Yid who just had his bone marrow transplant starts to sit up in his bed, okay? He sits up in his bed, and he swings his legs over, and he's wearing his hospital gown, and he stands up. Can I walk away from the camera? I'll just do it in front of the camera. Huda. Doesn't matter. He stands up, and he starts to walk, and he takes his IV pole, and he starts to walk towards the armoire, and the nurse says, I thought he was going to fall on the floor. And he walks towards the armoire, and he opens up the doors, and he reaches in, and he takes off his bibahit. You know what a bibahit is? Right? Takes off his chassidish hat, and he puts it on his head, and then he walks over to the sink, and he washes negelvasser, and then he goes back, and he grabs his talis and tefillin off, and he puts that on his bed. And the nurse, I thought, was going to pass out. Pass out! He goes, I don't get it. I've never seen this before. How does somebody who just had a bone marrow transplant get out of his bed, put on his hat, wash his hands, and now he wants to pray? He goes, you people are just amazing. And Beinish said, while he acknowledged that we people are amazing, he said, perhaps it's not just that. He said, perhaps had we been here before and we would have told him that you're not going to get out of bed for the next 48 hours, he just wouldn't even think about getting out of bed. But nobody ever told him that he couldn't do it. So perhaps, because nobody told him to do it, that he couldn't do it, he was able to do it. So he said, so Beinish said, perhaps that's a lesson that we can all learn. That we can all learn. Is that don't tell somebody that they can't do something. Tell them that they could, and if you think they can, don't tell them anything. But definitely don't tell anybody that they can't do it. One of the things that Shlomo always told us as well was to always make a Kiddush Hashem, wherever you go, people look at you, you're wearing a hat on your head, you're wearing an Or Shlomo sweatshirt. People, it's a uniform that we wear. And you always have to make sure to do that. So I mentioned before, I'm in the aviation business. And last year, just around a little after Pesach time, I was trying to get into this conference called the NBAA conference. It's a National Business Aviation Association conference that takes place in White Plains, an airport, once a year. Very hard to get in, very few spots available. It books up in the first 15 minutes that the show opens up online. All the booths are taken. I was growing my business because we have, as I said, we built an app for a thing called urgentflights.com, and I was gonna launch it at this conference. And I remember it was about a month before the conference, and I'm talking to somebody about the dates, and I'm going, and he's like, "So is that before Shavuos or after Shavuos?" I said, no, it's before Shavuos. Shavuos is the next week. He goes, "Can you tell me those dates again?" And I tell him, he goes, "No, I think Shavuos is that week." I said, "No, it's not. I checked. I remember I Googled when Shavuos is going to be." He said, "Maybe you Googled 2023 and not 2024. I thought I was going to pass out. And I open my phone and I look. It's Shavuos. Shavuos is starting Tuesday night. This conference was Wednesday morning, first day Shavuos. I worked so hard. I worked for 6 months. I paid for my booth. I paid for it all. I had already ordered. I had made reservations for some of our staff members to come flying in. Everybody was allocated to come to this big show that's going to launch our new business." And I said, "Not doing it. We're not doing it." And I have some non-Jewish people who work, and they said, "Listen, this is the biggest show ever. We'll go. We'll go. I said, it's a question I would ask myself all the time. You know what it is? What would Shlomo do? I said, I cannot go to this show. So I called him up. I called up the NBAA and I said, you wouldn't believe it. I booked the event and I can't go to your show. So I'm going to cancel. I said, you can cancel. You don't get your money back. I said, I don't get my money back. Okay. I'm not going to cancel. I said, I'm going to keep the booth. And I put a sign in the booth that said, this booth is closed for the holiday of Shavuos. No apologies, no nothing. But that's what our booth said, because it's about making a Kiddush Hashem. Now, I don't know how many people there knew what the holiday of Shavuos is, but it's important to do that. And I'll tell you where I learned this part from. There's somebody in Lakewood. His name is Jack Mueller, Rabbi Yankel Mueller. He's my father's age, been around for a very, very long time. And I heard a story from a friend of mine named Morty Eisenberg, who used to work for him. He used to have two seats on the New York Stock Exchange. He was called a, I don't know if they called a broker, a broker dealer, whatever he was, but he used to sell stocks. He used to market stocks, and he had two seats on the New York Stock Exchange. And one time before Pesach, Jack Mueller calls in my friend Morty Eisenberg, and he says, Morty, I need you to just leave a message on the voicemail that says, we are closed, okay, for these 2 days for Pesach. And Morty says, okay, he picks up the phone, he dials it. It was very different before cell phones and everything else, but he leaves this message on the machine, and it says, hi, thank you for calling Mueller & Company. We apologize, but we're going to be closed for the holiday of Passover, and we'll reopen on whatever day it was. And he walks back in, and Jack Mueller hears it, and he says, nope, got to re-record it. Anybody know what was wrong with the message? I just told you guys what the message was. Who said apology? Apology. What's wrong with an apology? We're not sorry. You're absolutely right. Because he said, we are not. He said, you can say the same message again. Just take out those words. I apologize. Because we're not sorry. Because we keep Yom Tov. And that's what we do. And we'll always get this chosim of keeping Yom Tov and everything else that they do. So that's what we did. There was no apology on our note. Our note merely said that this booth from Paraflight and UrgentFlights.com is closed for the holiday of Shavuos. And I will just tell you that just last week, we actually booked for 2025. It's going to be in June. And it actually takes place the day after Shavuos. Shavuos actually is going to be Sunday night, Monday, Tuesday. And this is going to be on Wednesday. So that's something that we've learned. But I want to tell you guys about something that took place many, many years ago before I was even born. And then we're going to open it up to questions. Okay? In the 1950s, there was a Dr. Kurt Richter in Harvard University. Anybody ever hear of Harvard University in Boston? And he decided to do some research. And what they did was they wanted to try to figure out how long rats, you might see them walking around in Brooklyn somewhere, but how long rats could actually tread water before they would drown. That's what he did. So they took all these rats and they put them in these like buckets of water. And on average, the rats lasted about 15 minutes. They would tread water for 15 minutes and they would sink to the bottom. And as soon as they would sink, they don't let them die. As soon as they would sink, the researchers would pick up these rats, they would towel them off, and they would allow them to rest for a few minutes and they would place them back in. Okay? So we just said how long? 15 minutes, right? On the second time around, how long do you guys think they lasted? Now keep in mind, they swam until absolute failure just a few minutes ago. How long?
15 minutes.
Who said 15 hours? Who said 15 hours? Okay.
I'd say a minute or two.
A minute or two. Okay, we're getting there. Rabbi Moshe, how long do you think they lasted? 25. Okay. There must be a cheshbon of 25. You?
10 seconds.
An hour. Who said 15 hours? You were close, but you were not close. 60 hours. 60 hours. That, if you went to your math class, would be 240 times as long as they lasted on their initial 15 minutes. So what's the shot? What happened? Why do you think that happened?
Psychological.
That what? What is your name?
Yaakov.
Yaakov. That is brilliant. Because the researchers in Harvard agree with you. They said exactly what you said. That because the rats believed that they would eventually be rescued, they could push their bodies way past anything they could have ever thought possible. Right? So I'm going to leave you guys all with this thought. If hope can cause exhausted rats to swim for that long, what could a belief in ourselves do, right? We have to always remember what we're capable of and why we're here. And we should never forget that we should always keep swimming. So thank you for inviting me, and thank you for listening, and I wish you all a wonderful day. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. Sure.
If the rats knew they would be safe, wouldn't it be counterintuitive to continue swimming? Just fall in 1 second and you'd say that you're
good. That's a great question. I don't know the answer, but we can ask Dr. Kurt Richter. I don't think he's around anymore. But it's a brilliant, brilliant question. But I guess they figured that at some point they're going to get rescued.
If they figured that they're going to get rescued, why would it start trying in the first place?
Why would they what? Something like that. I never thought of that question, but it's a good one. Yeah. So that's good. I should have spoken that in my speech. So I'll tell you. So what happened was Shlomo owned his own jet. Okay, he had a private jet that he utilized for chesed. And he introduced me to that. And when he was very, very sick, he was in Sloan Kettering, he called me and he would send me and other paramedics. He actually, at his own expense, aside from the jet, he actually put in a stretcher and oxygen. He would send me and other paramedics around the country with people. I flew with Shlomo not only to Cuba, but we flew to the Bahamas to take people who were terminally ill. I'm swimming with the dolphins. I would fly with patients to specialty hospitals. And Shlomo was sitting on his hospital bed in Sloan, and he called me in, and he said, I wanted to take my jet. I said, oh, okay, well, where am I going? He goes, oh, no, take my jet. I said, and go where? Because I wanted to open up a business, and I wanted to go change the world. He said, but I never wanted to forget the chesed component, which is the most important thing of everything that we do. We always have to incorporate chesed into our lives. And he passed away, and I didn't take his jet because it was too overwhelming for me to go start spending money on a jet and having pilots. But I opened up right after he passed away, and I opened it up in his memory. And just so you know that everything I do, and I speak about Shlomo all the time, and I will tell you that even our vehicles, and it's actually one sitting right outside right now, our vehicle is called F-32, one of our vehicles, the first one we had, and it says on it, the memory of Shlomo Zakheim. Because everything we do is in memory of people who passed away. Not to make a plug, but I'll just tell you that actually in this week's Ami magazine, there's an article that just came out today about the chesed that we do. And I attribute it all to Shlomo Zakheim, who was my Rebbe and my mentor in chesed, because that's what he told me. He says, always look for an opportunity to say yes. But that's how I got into aviation. And why I went into organ transplants is because actually Shlomo had introduced me to a young man named Yochi Rubi. Yochi Rubi was in Camp Simcha. Yochi Rubi needed a lung. I flew with him all over the country to get it. Unfortunately, he didn't get it in time. And actually, Shlomo needed a lung as well. He didn't actually pass away from the cancer. He passed away from the destruction of his lungs by the chemotherapy. And I said, I'm going to do whatever I can to help people who need to get valuable organs to be able to save their lives. And that's what we do every single day, is we help people get hearts and lungs and livers and kidneys and the occasional pancreas to help prolong their life. Great question. Anybody else?
What is the furthest you've ever gone?
Or Anchorage, Alaska. I'm sorry. We went to Anchorage, Alaska to take a heart to Vancouver, British Columbia. That's the furthest that we've gone. But I will tell you that it's interesting to note that the heart can only stay out of the body for between 4 and 6 hours. So generally our trips are anywhere between 40 minutes flight time up to 245. So we have transplant centers in Florida, so we'll go to Puerto Rico. We're in Texas, we'll go to Oklahoma and some other states out there. But for the most part, we try to get it there in under 4 hours.
Are there a lot of flights that you guys do, or is it once in a while?
For organs?
Yeah.
Almost every day.
Really?
Yeah. There's many flights. People don't realize the different factors that go in to saving lives. But think about it. If somebody's in New York and they need to get a heart, but there's only, you know, you're limited to the area of, an hour and a half or so around here. But if they can go out of Atlanta, Georgia, or they can go to Florida, they go to other states. So the organs, the hearts, the lungs, the livers go to the sickest people. And most of the time, it requires a plane ride. Now, it's not just for us, because as I mentioned before, we're doing a trip right now in Ohio. So we're getting the heart. I mean, our team is getting the heart. So, but somebody still has to get the lung, and somebody has to get the liver, and somebody's going to get the kidneys that are probably going to be split. So there are many different teams and planes that are coming in at the same time to just go get these organs. Yes?
Where do you get the organs from?
From people who are, unfortunately, have no brain activity. So if they were in a car accident or potentially a drug overdose, and it's just interesting to note that many of the states that have no helmet laws for their motorcycles have the highest percentage of organ donors, because they get these traumatic brain injuries and now they're brain dead. So don't ride motorcycles. How's that? And if you do, make sure to wear a helmet. Anybody? What?
How many jets, like helicopters, you guys have?
So we don't own any helicopters or jets. We actually have resources. We built an app, like an Uber type app, but for aircraft. We have about 100, I think as of this morning, 184 operators are there, representing about 1,500 aircraft that we have on our app. So we can go out and source it so we can grow. So if you build a business, whatever it might be, and that was a decision that we made when we started our business, that we wanted to be able to scale, but we wanted to remain asset light so we can expand very quickly. Does anybody know who the largest taxi company is in the world? Uber, you're correct. How many cars do they own? Zero. Who is the largest hospitality company in the world? Hospitality, like rooms, hotel rooms, whatever. Airbnb. And right, so they're able to scale. So that's what we did. We did an Uber-type business, but instead of cars, we have aircraft for them. Anybody else? I would like to take this opportunity to thank Yehuda Leib Blonder for bringing me here. Yehuda Leib has been my friend since the first day I walked into Camp Simcha. The first day I walked in, Yehuda Leib. And we worked together in Revival. And we hung out together. We spent Shabbosim together. And Yehuda Leib is one of my dearest and closest friends. He's my brother, and I love you, Yehuda Leib. You're a special person. Everybody give a big hand to Yehuda Leib. Thank you. And Rav Moshe, I'm truly blessed to have you in my life. You and your family. Your mom's Zalzan Gazon, Dr. Faye, Rabbi Israel, and all the trips that we do, we still do, by the way, every single summer, in memory of Reb Shlomo, we do helicopter trips for all these children. Yes, Ramesh.
One last question. In Yeshiva, we have a Chesed Club. The Chesed Club.
Can I join?
You should definitely join.
Okay.
It's by Ariel over there.
Yeah.
So far,
unbelievable.
Do you have any advice to give to them? Some sort of something to them?
Never say no and never give up and always look for more opportunities. People want to help out. They really, really do. Baruch Hashem, the Jewish community is so, so generous and so philanthropic that people have to do it. And sometimes you give somebody an opportunity. So who raises money here for the Chesed? You guys need money for it? What do you do that you need money for? Tell me.
Ubers,
right. So what you would do is, and I'll even put you in touch with somebody who would help you, that what you should do is give people an opportunity to do it. Is it a daily cost? Once a week. How much does it cost?
$20?
$20 for a week of chesed? You know what kind of schus that is? I'm going to give you $500. I'm buying 25 weeks of chesed. Beautiful. The memory of Shlomo Zakkai. But you should sell this chesed. You should tell somebody, what an opportunity. Can you imagine? For $500, I just bought 25 weeks of chesed. This is an unbelievable opportunity that I had. And now sell the next one. And you should take it from $20. I'm sure you could do more chesed than that. And just expand on it. Maybe it'll be $100 or $500 or $1,000 that people will spend to do chesed. That's a great thing. You guys do all the work. And we just have to give them money. That's the best partnership ever. It's much easier for me. You guys are doing the work. I just have to give them money. So thank you for that chus. But that's the way you do it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. All right, so come, I'll give you the money right now. Here you go. 25 weeks of chesed.